So on this Sunday, historically, the church has set it aside annually for us to consider the pattern of life, which is resurrection. And so I thought it'd be appropriate for us to have a conversation about resurrection this morning. Cool? So why don't we do this? Just turn to a neighbor, and when you think of resurrection, what comes to mind? Just share it with a neighbor. All right? Go. All right, what are we thinking? Resurrection, what comes to mind? Death. Good. Anybody else? Well, I heard a voice over here. One more time. Okay, I heard renewal there. Anybody else? Jon Snow. Okay. Anybody else? Hope. Good. Well, I was thinking through this, and a couple weeks ago during spring break, we took a trip with my family, and we were up in northern New Mexico in the high desert, which I love. And so for the first few days, we stayed in an earthship. You can show these pictures. They're 600 acres. There are these structures that are completely off the grid. The walls are made with tire and packed with mud. They have solar panels. You can keep showing them. And then they collect the rainwater, and the rainwater is used four times. Go one more time. And then this next picture is the actual one we stayed in. And so it was beautiful, and the sky was unique and only, you know, that you find in New Mexico. Then for the second half of our trip, we were going to stay at a garlic farm. And so we had to pack up all of our stuff, and we were going to load the car and then drive about an hour south, kind of towards Taos and Santa Fe. And so it was kind of up early. I had my coffee, and then I could just tell the boys were kind of sleepy and getting up. And so I proceeded to give them a pep talk / maybe lecture. So I sat them down, I was like, hey guys. And to their credit, they're usually super helpful. They were kind of sick, so I thought the pep talk might be useful. And I was like, all right, so in our family, there's two roles you can play. And you get to choose, okay? You can be a passive recipient or you can be an active participant, okay? As a passive recipient, this is what you do. You just lay there. You play your iPad or your computer games, and then you don't do anything unless asked. And if you don't like what you've been asked to do, you complain and you groan. You go, oh, that is a passive recipient. You can do that. That's a choice that you have. Or you can be an active participant. This is what active participants do. They look around and they see what needs to be done, and then they do it. And active participants go, this is not somebody else's family. This is my family. This isn't somebody else's vacation. This is my vacation. And so part of my pep talk / lecture was so you guys can choose. And probably being a passive recipient is easier. But I promise you, if you're an active participant, there's going to be more meaning. We're all going to have more fun. So you can choose. And so the boys chose. They were active participants. And we all had a great time. I wonder if the question this morning is worth asking. When it comes to resurrection, are we passive recipients or are we active participants? I find myself defaulting into the passive recipient role. I'm like, oh God, what needs to be resurrected, right? Okay, or got to resurrect that again. Come on, God. Like I find myself just kind of like groaning and complaining. Or probably more often, I just find this idea of resurrection so distant and kind of like this idle ancient story. And I'm like, well, what does it even mean? Like, it's just something we celebrate like year after year. And I wonder if this morning, what would it look like if we became active participants here now in our lives, in this city, in our neighborhoods, in our workplaces of resurrection that's still happening? Eugene Peterson says it like this. The practice of resurrection is an intentional, deliberate decision to believe. And I think a lot of us just stop there, but I think it's more than that. To believe, but also as important, if not more important, to participate in the resurrection life life out of death, life that trumps death, life that is the last word, Jesus' life. And so I wanted to ask that question this morning. And so in our text this morning, all of the men, almost all of them are kind of like the passive recipients. They're kind of like, oh, this movement is lame. I can't believe he's dead, right? And then the women all along the way are active, they're engaged, and they're participating in the process. And I wonder if we can learn something from the women in this story this morning. So we'll be in the gospel text in Luke chapter 24. We'll have 1-9 on the screen. Go ahead and read it and we'll walk through. All right, Luke 24, go. All right, let's pick this up in verse 1. So Luke's writing, and he says, on the first day of the week on Sunday, the sun was rising, it was early at dawn. And then it says they, and later in the text, we find out it's two Marys, Joanna, and some other women. So they're going with spices so that other people come visit the body, it won't smell too bad. So they go and visit the body. And then in verse 2, they found the stone rolled away from the tomb. But when they went in, they did not find the body. While they were perplexed, they were confused. They didn't understand what was happening about this. And then suddenly, two men in dazzling clothes stood beside them. So I propose that as this story starts in that morning, like everyone's confused. They have no idea what's going on. Like this movement that they left their homes for, they left their family for, they thought this guy was going to be the Christ, the Messiah. They crowned him. He was going to upthrow the government politically. He was going to overthrow the power structures of the church. And then not only does he get arrested, he's publicly executed. It's an embarrassment. And the whole thing crumbles. And they're like, what is going on? We don't understand what's happening. And I wonder if a question that's worth asking for us this morning, when we don't understand something, how do we respond? When we don't understand something, do we maybe respond like Peter? That's how I respond. If I don't understand something, I try to defend. Guys, here, right? I don't understand it. My reptilian brain tells me for most centuries that we've lived, if I don't understand something, I probably should kill it or it's going to kill me, right? Or I wonder, what if we responded like the women? They didn't understand. They were as confused, but they engaged it with curiosity. They're like, okay, I don't understand what's happening, but I'm going to go in the morning. I'm going to go check out the tomb. Oh, I don't, the stone's rolled. I don't understand, but I'm going to go in. Oh, it's empty. I don't understand. And each step of the way, there's relentless curiosity. I was listening to, do you guys listen to Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson? Yeah. So did you listen to the interview with him and David Byrne of the Talking Heads? So when he had David Byrne on, he's a musician and an artist, I was a little confused. I was like, what do these two guys have in common? One's an astrophysicist, and then one's like a world-renowned musician and artist. And then as they were talking, they were saying, even though the disciplines are on the far end of each spectrum, right? The one thing that unites both disciplines is this pursuit of curiosity. They said it's actually the same. In both art and science, you start with a question, and then you engage and you manipulate the materials or the resources, and then you have an outcome. So as they were talking, they actually posed a really interesting question. Neil deGrasse Tyson said, in science, when someone has curiosity and they engage a question and they discover something, he says, like Einstein, discovers the theory of relativity. He says, if Einstein didn't discover it, someone along the way probably would have. And so his discovery is not singular. And what Neil deGrasse Tyson thinks, he says, in art, he says, the pursuit of curiosity is more singular. He says, if Beethoven didn't write the Ninth Symphony, it probably would have never been written. And then David Byrne responds, he actually disagrees. He actually says, if Beethoven didn't write the Ninth Symphony, something very similar would have been written. He says there were a lot of musicians at that time. The zeitgeist would have led them, had the same access to the same instruments, the same music halls, the same commissioning people. And he says, whatever was written may not have sounded exactly like the Ninth Symphony, but in that era, it probably would have sounded more like Beethoven than Bach. Is that interesting? And I was listening to this, and I just thought it was fascinating that for centuries, the church was a key player with math and science and physics and architecture in the pursuit of truth and beauty, right? We were as curious as everybody else. And then somewhere along the way, our pursuit of truth became the defense of truth, and we lost our beauty. And I wonder what it would look like for us to rediscover that as the church, to be as curious, if not more curious, than anyone else in the world. Do you remember the story of when the disciples are trying to shoo the children away because they're like distracting, right? And then Jesus goes, unless you're like a child, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven, unless you change. And I used to think that meant unquestioning belief until I had my own child. Because you don't ask children to ask more questions. You kind of ask, just like, okay, can you just stop asking questions for a second? Like, just give me a break. Like, just take a deep breath, right? And I wonder if Jesus is saying, truly I tell you, unless you change and become as curious as little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. And I wonder if we read in the scriptures, if we read faith, and one of the key components of faith was curiosity. Here's a quote by Rollheiser. He says, the biblical tradition, Jesus in particular, prays faith or curiosity even more than love. Why? Maybe because curiosity is that patience with mystery that allows you to negotiate the stages. As Gerald May points out in Dark Night of the Soul, it allows God to lead you through darkness where God knows and I don't. This is the only way to come to love. Love is the true goal, but maybe curiosity is the process of getting there. Hope is the willingness to live without resolution or closure. And I just thought, what would be some things that'd be worth being curious about on this Easter Sunday? What if we were curious about each other's theological differences? I find myself in this weird kind of paradox sometimes. So when I talk to folks who come from fundamentalist traditions, I'm trying to convince them that they don't need to defend. But in doing so, I'm defending the need to not defend. And it doesn't, I had this conversation recently, and I actually think as a pastor, I would be a better pastor if I became more curious. Just ask them, why do you think that? Where does that come from? What if we were more curious during this presidential election? Maybe, right? What if we surrounded us with people who didn't just agree with us? And then that's my response. I just want to come out with knives and swords. What if we came out with a little more curiosity? I think it would help the conversation a little bit. What if maybe on this Easter Sunday in particular, what if we became more curious about our sin? Because there's this weird cycle that we get ourselves into. So I believe that sin is behavioral things that come from shame, which means I'm not enough. I'm not inherently lovable. So I do all these things to be loved, and out of those things become behavior. And we live in generations of shame. So out of generations doing that, we live in the trauma of being born into that. Does that make sense? So sin is a result of the shame that we have. Okay. So then the church teaches us to engage these behavioral things with more shame. Which to me is like, well, doesn't that just lead to other more destructive behaviors? And what if on this Easter, Christ died for the, we are utterly and completely loved. That's it. And he's like, be curious about, there's no shame in these behaviors, but there's healing and wholeness that's promised there. And what if we became a curious community? Not more than just being strange. We're already that, but intellectually curious. Let's keep going in the text. So they're in there, and then these men appear, and then they're terrified, they're afraid. And I want to propose these 3 days have probably been shrouded in anxiety and fear. There's a lot of fear, right? Then the women were terrified, and then they bowed their faces to the ground. But the men said to them, "Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here, but he is risen. Remember how he told you while he was still in Galilee that the Son of Man must be handed over to sinners and be crucified. And on the third day will rise again." And then they remembered his words. Like, oh yeah, I remember that, right? But I want to talk about the terror and the anxiety and the fear a little bit. And for us, when we're afraid, when we have anxiety, how do we approach it? Do we cower? Are we just passive? I propose this is what the men are doing. They're just like, oh, this movement is the worst. Just dead. I don't have a job. I'm going to have to fish again, right? And I propose the women were equally afraid. They were afraid. They knew that by going to the tomb, their lives could be in danger, but they went in and they explored. They engaged their fears. And as a parent, I kind of understand this. As a parent, when my children were young, part of it was to help them understand what were appropriate fears and inappropriate fears, right? And then for inappropriate fears, for them to be able to engage it. So an appropriate fear would be a man in a van with candy. You should be very afraid, right? Always, just rule, okay? And then I remember, so every kid is different, every situation is different. I remember my older son, he would always say, "Dad, I'm afraid of heights." And I would tell him, "You know, son, actually, everyone's afraid of heights. And there are heights that you should be afraid of because it keeps you alive, right? But there are some heights that you don't have to be afraid of." So we were in the CN Tower in Toronto, which is one of the tallest buildings in the world. They have this glass ceiling. I have a picture of it. And he was a little guy. I remember taking him, we'll come back to that. So the picture looks like this. And I was like, "Hey, Joshua, you want to step out on it?" He said, "Dad, I'm afraid of heights." I'm like, "It's okay. I'll go with you," right? So I took his hand and he just grabbed me. He was like terrified and he was holding me. And I was like, "You can do it." And then he closes his eyes and we step out on it and he opens one eye and he's like, "Oh, hey, we're still alive," right? Then we step back. I was like, "You want to do it again?" He's like, "Oh, I'm scared." I said, "We can do this," right? And then because of the first time he did it, the second time he's like, "Oh, maybe I can do this." And then today, because I've taught him so well, he stands on structures like this. And I'm like, "That's kind of high. Maybe you should get down. Like, that seems kind of dangerous." He's like, "No, Dad, right? You want to come up here?" And I was like, "No, I don't want to go up there." And then I asked him, and I was like, "Hey, are you afraid of heights anymore?" He's like, "Yeah. I still feel that same feeling. But I know now that I can do it." I remember when he was in fifth grade, and I asked him if he wanted to read a prayer at Fox. And he's like, "Dad, I'm terrified of saying anything in front of people." And I go, "So am I. Actually, everyone is." And he's like, "What?" I was like, "Yeah, I talk in front of people all the time. And those butterflies, I still have the same butterflies." So he didn't really want to do it, but I kind of forced him into it, right? And after he read the prayer, he's like, "Oh, I'm still alive," right? And I think this is what Brother Curtis means. Can we go back to that quote? When he says this, "Pray for the conversion of your anxiety. When anxiety is converted, you know what it becomes? Anxiety becomes hope." Nadia Boltz-Weber says it like this: if you have anxiety now, you are almost hopeful. You're like super close. I remember when, for the first time, I heard the metaphor when Jesus said, God is like a mother hen protecting its chicks. And I remember thinking, oh, that feels so safe and secure, until I had chickens. Because chickens have a lot of things going for them, like they're super cute, they're super entertaining. The one skill set they don't have is protecting anything or themselves. They're like terrible at staying alive, right? Like, they're the worst. Like, they're the worst at staying alive. And I was like, why does God use that metaphor? And his promise is this, that whatever you're afraid of, I might not come with power and eliminate whatever you're afraid of. But I promise you presence, and I promise you affection. I'll be with you. And I wonder on this Easter Sunday, what is the one fear that we could engage together? And I propose that maybe the underlying fear behind all fears, most fears, is that fear of resurrection. Am I actually lovable and loved? If I took off this mask and this projection that I'm trying to show the world, my talent, my looks, my hair, my glasses, my whatever it is, if it was gone, would people still love me? And I think on this Easter, God's saying, I know it feels terrifying. And I know it feels like if you take that step, you might die. But trust me, you are lovable. And let's do this together as a community. Richard Rohr says it like this. The fears that assault us are mostly simple anxieties about social skills, intimacy, about likableness or performance. We need not give emotional food or charge to these fears or become attached to them. We don't even have to shame ourselves for having these fears. Simply ask your fears, what are you saying to me about what is real? What are you trying to teach me? Some say fear is merely an acronym for false evidence appearing real. Ask yourself, what am I afraid of? Does it matter? Will it be there anyway at the end? Is it worth holding on to? We have to ask whether it is fear that keeps us from loving you, from loving. I promise you, grace will lead us into those fears and voids. And grace alone will fill them up if we are willing to stay in the void. We mustn't engineer an answer too quickly. We must not get too settled too fast. For it is so easy to manufacture an answer to take away the anxiety. To stay in God's hands, to trust, means that to a certain degree, I have to stop taking hold of myself. I have to hold instead a degree of uncertainty, fear, and tension. It takes both practice and grace. And I love that in this story, the women, they're just as afraid. They don't know what's going to happen, but they run to the tomb. And then in verse 9, and returning from the tomb, they told all this to the 11 and to all the rest. Now it was Mary Magdalene, Joanna, Mary the mother of James, and some other woman with them, who told this to the apostles. But these words to the men who'd done nothing, right? Seemed like an idle tale. That's an idle tale, right? I don't believe you. We're men. This is a patriarchal society, right? So they just don't do anything. Like, they're kind of condescending. And then, but Peter, so you got to give Peter credit. He doesn't do it well or correct, but he does something, right? Like, he cuts off a guy's ear, not even a strong guy, like a servant of some guy, but at least he swung. He did something, right? So he denies Christ, of course he denies, but at least he followed them. And in this, he didn't believe. He's probably like, you're wrong. I'm going to go and show you that you're wrong. Then he gets to the tomb and goes, this is amazing, right? And I propose that out of the 11, even though he's kind of stubborn, a little bit dull, but at least he goes and he enters in. And I wonder if resurrection is like that. That if you stand on the side, maybe we'll never experience, but if we run towards it and we'll go, wow, resurrection is still happening here and now. So when we were in New Mexico, the main thing we were trying to do over our spring break was to visit the Taos Pueblo. And this is a picture of it. This is not my picture because this is like the main thing we wanted to do. We were driving there and we saw some police blocking the roads and they were doing this, like turn around. And it turned out that they were having cultural festivals there during the entire month, which is great. I'm really glad they're having cultural festivals, just not while I drove 12 hours there. So I was kind of like, aw, can't see the Pueblos, right? So we turned around and then I pouted for a little bit. And then that night I, you know, got curious a little bit. So I started looking around the internet. I wonder what else is around here in New Mexico. And I found this video.
Sometimes I feel more like an archaeologist uncovering something that's already there.
It's pretty down and dirty work. I've tried to tell young guys, you can do this. You can have a cave of your own. It doesn't register.
He has a shovel in his hand. He's like a coke addict with piles of coke. He just wants to keep going and going.
Horace's not your typical person. He doesn't do things for himself. He does things for art.
I've had ideas for ages that I've never gotten to try. I want to create a space that's transformative. That's a big goal.
So apparently in that part of New Mexico, there's this guy named Raw Paulette who's been digging his own caves with like a pick, then he'd wheelbarrow out the sand. And then we found out that it was within like 30 minutes of where we were staying. So I go to the family. I was like, there are these caves near us and they're on private property. And our goal tomorrow, we have to find one of these caves. We probably have less than a 50% chance of success. Who's in? And my family's like, we're in. We're going, right? So the next morning, our only goal was to find one of these caves. So we thought they were kind of in Ojo Caliente, which is about like 30, 40 minutes from us. So we got up. We stopped at the local co-op to get medicine for our boys because they were sick. And then some snacks. And then as I was checking out, this kind old lady at the counter, I was just like, hey, so have you heard of these Rob Paulette art caves? And she's like, oh, yeah, I've heard of them. It's like, have you been in one? I hear they're in Ojo Caliente. She's like, oh, I've never been in the ones in Ojo Caliente. Have you been in any other ones? She goes, there's a couple around here, but they're private property. And I was like, oh, my gosh, there's some around here. So I look at her, like kind of like a crazy person. And then I go, is there any way to ask politely how to get on one of these? Like, I don't even know why she responded to me. She's like, you are insane. But she goes, she pauses, and she was like, yeah. And then she writes down two names, and she goes, look them up in the white pages. I was like, people still use the white pages? This is amazing, right? So I get on the phone. And then I go to the car. The boys are like, what's wrong with you? You're like, I've never seen you this giddy. I'm like, we found a game. So I call the guy and he's like, oh yeah, we're just 3 miles down the road. Come on over. Okay. As I'm like dancing, I'm like having like a happy dance. This man walks by with a hat with sunglasses. I do a double take and I go, excuse me, sir, what's your name? And he goes, Raw Paulette. And I was like, so I made him sit down. I took a picture of him. And this is him just humoring me. There's an excitable Chinese man in New Mexico, and we're not sure what's happening. And then so for the rest of the afternoon, our family, you can cycle through the next few pictures. We spent 3 hours in this cave alone. And in this cave, it's one of the few pieces of art where I've had to step into it. And it was interactive. If you go back to the first picture, in the middle of the floor, there's like a 20-foot like dugout, and it's a drum. So you dance on it, and then there's a drum. In some of those seats, like they orate different sounds. So one of them kind of resonates a bass, another one resonates a treble. And we just spent hours in there, and it was incredible and amazing. And this is the thing. To experience this, you can't stand on the outside of the cave. Because the outside of the cave looks like this. I have a picture of the door. And you look at it and you're like, huh. But if you're willing to engage and step in, go to the next picture, it's awe-inspiring and breathtaking. And I think St. Simeon maybe was thinking the same thing when he said this. He said this in the first century. My intellect sees what has happened, but it cannot explain it. It can see and wishes to explain, but can find no words that will suffice. For what it sees is invisible and entirely formless, simple, completely uncompounded, unbounded in its awesome greatness. What I've seen is the totality recapitulated as one, received not in essence, but in participation. I think Wendell Berry was maybe saying the same thing. Be like the fox who makes more tracks than necessary. Maybe he's talking about Peter, just kind of wanders around, sometimes in the wrong direction, and practice resurrection. And so, Vox, this is my prayer for us on this Easter Sunday. May we, Vox, participate in the resurrection of the Christ in us and through us. May we participate in the resurrection of all things, of small things, the resurrection of our curiosity, our hope, our love. May we participate in the resurrection of relationships, shame, trusting that we are utterly lovable and loved, that Christ died for the love of us, that in our trauma, wholeness and healing are at hand. May we be resurrected from the decay of performing to be seen, competing to be loved, fighting to be safe, and trust that in our terror, in our fears, we are so, so utterly close to blossoming into hope. May we be like the fox and make tracks all over our families, our neighborhoods, and our places of work. May we participate in resurrection, in life out of death, in life that trumps death, in life that is the last stanza of love. And when we see it, and find no words to articulate, love that is you, O God, your essence, your grace, your mercy, uncompounded, unbounded, awesome in greatness. And we pray this in the name of the all-loving Father, the relentless grace of the Son, and the gentle compassion of the Holy Spirit. Amen.